I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. And the general theme of what we're all going through in the Obama moment, this one is with the novelist Rick Moody of The Ice Storm and other wrathful fiction about what are now 40-somethings. Rick Moody has been read as a generational figure, a rebuke to the parents in the novels of John Updike, say, or Philip Roth. But Moody himself is 47 now. He'll become a first-time father about the time Barack Obama takes the presidential oath. And it turns out all his perspectives are shifting. Rick Moody, we count on novelists, more than anybody maybe, to tell us what we're going through in this strange Obama moment, we call it, end of 2008. Wars starting, wars ending, the economy in meltdown. What's up? Where is the game?
I was asked by The Guardian recently to write a little squib about the comic novel in American literature in the last 100 years for a list they're making of the 1,000 greatest books of all time. And I went through and I picked a few. I picked A Time to Be Born by Don Powell, Catch-22 by Heller, Breakfast of Champions by Vonnegut, and Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace.
Good list.
All of them being really scabrous, really creative, really imaginative, and in some ways sort of anti-capitalist, anti-mainstream American culture successes. Great books, every one. And as I was writing about them, I went through and I picked out the presidential administration for each book. Powell is during Roosevelt. Heller's book is Kennedy. Breakfast of Champions comes during the height of Watergate. And Infinite Jest comes during the second term of Clinton. So based on this very thumbnail sketch, I think the preliminary conclusion would have to be that in progressive political moments, you get the really good stuff, or you find ultimately that you have the opportunity to help the system by being fervent in your depictions of its excesses and so forth. So my sense is, and I say this as someone who wrote work that was implicitly and occasionally explicitly very critical of the Bush years and American culture during the Bush years, my sense is that there will be some kind of flowering. You know, the 60s came after the 50s, and there will be a cultural moment that's different from the combative, fractious, internecine politics of the early 21st century. And I have a wish that this might be the moment that that really begins to change, and history moves dialectically back in the other direction.
What might it be? What are the threads to pick up?
Well, I am reading Dreams from My Father by Obama right now, his first book, which was the one he wrote not long after he was editor of the Harvard Law Review,
right,
and just a political youngster, you know. And I have it on good authority from some friends who are close to the man. He really wrote it himself. You know,
no
it's
question.
Not ghosted. There's no literary fakery involved at all. And I think it's an extraordinary book. You know, and it's not Audacity of Hope and the stump speeches from the general election and so forth are long on, you know, the kinds of abstractions that move people's hearts in a way. But Dreams from My Father is a exacting and brutally honest book about race. And so I sort of feel like this is a guy who, he's not just saying we should unite and overcome our differences and work together to make things better. Sure, that's great. Everyone thinks that's great. But it's not going to work if it's not founded on genuine, accurate perceptions of the differences undergird this attempt at unity and so forth. And so I sort of feel like reading this book that the model is, to begin with, that honest account of where we were in the last as you were saying earlier, really the last 40 years, I mean, Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, excusing the brief blip of the Clinton years, you know, where we've been and what the sort of self-interest run amok has done to culture and has done to some of our cherished ideals. And so
we'll come back to the 40 years, but stick with the Obama book. There is this very brave and open kind of invention of his own identity and who he is. Is it conceivable that that could become a kind of national story for all of us? I keep thinking the question really isn't what we're going to do in Afghanistan or any other particular place or policy. It's time to rethink who we are. Is it too much to hope that Obama's search could be everybody's search?
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying a little bit. You've said it more articulately than I could. But I think that's true. I mean, what that means to me, being an upper middle class white guy from the Connecticut suburbs, is obviously a lot different from what it means to, you know, people who are wanting to be enfranchised by the political process from, you know, the south side of Chicago or above 125th Street in New York or something. But if it means I recognize that my people in the Connecticut suburbs, you know, got more than their share for a few generations, and that's been part of what it means to be America, then, okay, I'm willing to admit that. And to try to create, as a writer, to try to create an art that begins with that kind of examination, you know, not the city on the hill Reagan stuff, you know.
So fascinating. I use this as a kind of polite term of abuse that the white guys from Connecticut, I mean, they've been running the world, our world, the son and grandson of Prescott Bush, as if it was Greenwich against the cosmos.
Yeah.
And in fact, we all know that the country is a great deal more like Obama. It's mixed, it's changing, it's Hispanic, it's Asian, it's poor, it's struggling, it's striving, it's smart. What in the world do we have to do to present ourselves that way to the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be it's likely to be an incremental process, but it begins today with the fact that we have this, you know, African-American guy who's going to be on the front page of the paper every day for at least the next 4 years, you know? And that, I don't know how you felt about it, but I did feel a tremendous exhilaration about it, you
know? Don't we all? Those kids in that White House.
Yeah.
Go back to the 40 years. It's fascinating. Rick Prostein calls it Nixon land. And it started really with, it is 40 years, Nixon's election, and particularly this kind of Nixonian, invidious division of the real guys and the suspect guys, and the good guys and the bad guys. Very nasty polarization, and especially with this great American worship of plainness and often stupidity as it came to be in the Bush administration. 40 years is long enough, but can we get out of Nixon land? I mean, you wrote about Nixon land too. I mean, that's been your subject in a way.
Yeah, I mean, Watergate certainly. For me, because I'm a little bit younger than you, the salient moment of political awakening was Watergate. When I was 12, I watched the hearings on TV. You know, I remember Vietnam and, you know, I was alive when Kennedy got shot, but I remember RFK getting shot a lot better. But the real salient moment of awakening was Watergate. And so that kind of the brutality of recognizing that this guy whom my parents lionized, I come from Republicans, you know, was not the shining example of public service that he appeared to be. That's what I remember from being 12. At the same time, I was learning about the bicameral Congress and the divisions of power. I was learning that power was abused. You know, that was very central to the politics of my generation. And most of the writers of my age feel the same way. That was an important moment. You know, my grandfather was the publisher of the New York Daily News, which was, you know, far to the right. And he wrote editorials in praise of the House on American Activities Committee and all that kind of stuff, like a real blood and guts Republican guy. He died during Watergate. He actually went into a coma and died out of disappointment in part, or my mother thinks it was partly out of disappointment.
They used to say nobody died at Watergate, but
apparently my grandfather did. Yeah, and was good friends with Nixon, actually, knew Nixon and everything, had written, was one of the newspaper people in Nixon's pocket, essentially, you know. So the point in answer to your question is that it takes a really long time to undo this stuff. You know, it can't be – Watergate wasn't enough. Watergate gave us 4 years of Carter, and then we were right back to where we were after that. So I think we all have to hope that what's happened in Congress in the election, as well as Obama's election, can create, you know, the possibility of more than 4 or 8 years of getting some other ideas heard. I think it needs that much time to really change people's attitudes and the generations that are coming up behind us.
What about the private stuff, Rick Moody, which has been the stuff of your novels? The pain in suburbia and its family and its booze and its drugs and its unhappiness of many varieties. Can you imagine that being kind of healed to some degree or curbed or redirected in a post-Nixon land time? Do societies recover from that kind of thing?
I think they do to a degree. I mean, obviously, in some ways, the two things are impossible to separate, the culture and the psychology of regular people, Americans, and the politics of the state. In The Ice Storm, when I wrote that book about suburbia, my idea was that the hypocrisy of Watergate trickled down directly into the sexual politics of the suburbs. So his hypocrisy was our hypocrisy. But that idea to me now seems like a young man's idea. And that the fact is that there's more mutual interdependence of these two registers of culture, if you will. I mean, the politics reflects what's already going on, and it in turn drives what happens after it, you know. So it's not as simple as a kind of unidirectional influence, you know. And so I think, again, it's not only going to take some time, but it's going to take a concerted effort by everyone to try to rethink all this stuff before we're out of where we were. But these things happen. I mean, the fact is when we look back at history, change takes place. I mean, the 60s really happened. It wasn't that we imagined 1965 to 1975. It really happened, you know.
But if politics reflects something much broader in the culture, what would we say this election year is telling us? What's the diagnosis?
I think Obama captured the center. This isn't such a monstrous landslide that we can say that the situation has changed entirely. It hasn't. I mean, there are all those places where Hillary did very well in the primaries, like Western Pennsylvania and West Virginia and all that kind of stuff. Those redoubts of unvarnished prejudice continue to exist. They're not going to just evaporate because we have an African-American guy in the White House. But I'm still optimistic. You know, I live in Brooklyn now, in Brooklyn, New York, and I'll give you two examples of what I see as, and these are totally anecdotal, but they're examples nonetheless, of what I see as a beginning of a change in attitudes in my city. The first was right after 9/11. I'd come back. I was in D.C., actually. I was doing work for the NEA that day. So I was two blocks from the White House and got evacuated to a hotel and spent the day not being able to get back to New York and so forth. But I got back about a day and a half later. And I was riding the subway, and there was a multiracial couple, a biracial couple, sitting across from me on the subway, a Jamaican guy, of African descent, and his white girlfriend sitting across from me. And the Jamaican guy was singing softly to himself. And as he was as they were getting up to get off the train, the guy got up, walked across the aisle to me, and kissed me for no reason. I was just sitting there. But everybody in this whole car was thinking, you know, this is the the B train. It's going to go over the Manhattan Bridge right past southern New York, where you could see the still smoking remains of the Trade Center buildings and so forth. It was all everyone was thinking about. But what they were thinking about at the moment was this stuff that was taking place in this city for the 30 years prior to this moment can't be sustained. We can't keep living like this, you know, at one another, red in tooth and claw about our differences and our violent distaste for one another and so forth. And then the second thing I would say is the night of the election in Brooklyn was unbelievable. It made New Year's Eve look like a dry run. It was so, and it really was all these people just feeling, you know, optimism and tremendous relief that maybe we didn't have to play out this, I got more money than you and fuck you. You know, maybe that's done for a while.
That's that end of the Nixon snarl, I think.
Yeah.
And suspicion and invidiousness and...
Right. Like, I might do business with you, but I'm going to record our conversations. You know?
Yeah. I always think of you, Rick Moody, as a child, not only of so much fiction that you've read, but of the fictionists of the mid-century. Son of Cheever, son of Updike, son of Mailer and Roth or whatever. As you grow up and you sort of outgrow those emotions of childhood, the wrath that Thomas Pynchon celebrates in your work, what's the next perspective?
That's a really interesting question. And the truth is, I'm about to have my first child in a couple
Praise
of months.
God.
Yeah, my wife's 6 months pregnant. And it's really obvious in me, in looking back at my career, it's really obvious to me that there was sort of intergenerational Oedipal, parasitical rage undergirding a lot of those early books. I felt when I was writing The Ice Storm that I was striking a blow for Rabbit Angstrom's children. That was uppermost
exactly.
in my mind. You know,
exactly.
I mean, Rabbit treats his children so despicably, you know, and the kids in the Cheever books don't get off so well either. I mean, they're just chattel. They're just something to be moved around from story to story. And so I felt like I wanted to say what it felt like to grow up with these swinging 60s parents and organizational men of the 50s and 60s.
The phallocrats, as David Foster Wallace called them.
Yeah. But I think that work's done. And Wallace is a good example because I think with the publication of Infinite Jest in 97, things really tilted around to my generation a little bit. It's also true that we are now ineluctably middle-aged adults, and our responsibility is to try to reflect more points of view and more kinds of psychology, the culture as a whole, if possible, from this vantage point that we have now. I can't anymore just write about my generation or just write about upper-middle-class white guys from the suburbs. I feel, and this may be a sort of an Obama perspective, this responsibility to try to have all kinds of characters in my work now.
Talk about a new beginning. Congratulations, and what a wonderful time to bring a child into the world.
I feel the same way. Economically devastating, but culturally so exciting.
Let's talk about the devastation a sec. We were puzzling with Chris Adrian the other day. Is it possible that hard times make for good art?
I think emphatically yes. The challenge is to write well about the good times.
Explain that.
It's much harder. What do you say about good times? I mean, the novel is a conflict resolution engine. It begins with a conflict and it proceeds to the conclusion of the conflict. And if it's all good times and you have no outsider's perspective on that, you have no conflict. So what can you write about? Language itself arises only in the need to say something. So why would you say anything if you were so content? They were awful quiet in the Garden of Eden. It wasn't until she ate the apple that they started chattering. But I do think, And it may be because the progressive times come after the reactionary times that suddenly there's that flowering to be able to talk about what you've just lived through. I mean, after all, fiction is reflective. It's almost most of the time in the past tense, so it's always looking back at what just happened.
How will we explain that? It's a bit of a mystery what we've been through the last 8 years. And it's easy to say now, but it didn't feel like us.
Well, you need perspective, too. I mean, think about the Vietnam novel. You've probably read a lot of these books.
Sure.
But what's the best Vietnam novel? I would say that it's The Things They Carried.
I would have, too.
Yeah, and that was published in 1986, right? So it was 13 years after the Paris peace talks. Mm-hmm. And it took that much time for the disparate feelings that we had about that experience to settle into a perfect book. I mean, there were other books that were great, Dispatches, you know, even going after Cacciato is pretty great.
Tim O'Brien was pretty great. I'm a big fan of Neil Sheehan's nonfiction.
Well, that's a masterpiece.
Bright Shining Lie. I mean, that is a great book, and it took him.
Right.
I knew I suffered with his writer's block, you know, in the same room. That took a great deal of digestion.
Yeah, and that's like 89 or so when that came out.
At least that late, yeah.
Yeah, or 90 maybe even. So this is all to say that how literature in general, not even the novel, literature in general digests this stuff is mysterious, but that perspective takes time, you know. Mm. So I would figure it's 10 years at least. And this is why the 9/11 novels have been failures so far. You know, I don't think Jonathan Foer's novel was terribly good, and the others that have attempted to capture that very experience. We don't know what we think of that yet.
We all hope that hard times make for good art, but it's also incredibly hard times, almost Black Tuesday in the publishing industry. Ugh. Doubleday died yesterday. Random House reorganized itself. Houghton Mifflin has virtually declared itself out of trade books for the next year. I mean, that's Philip Roth's publisher. How are writers thinking about this and thinking about alternative ways, including the web, to do what you do?
It's a terrifying moment in publishing, really. And I'm not convinced that the web is the solution yet. There was actually a really good James Glick essay about the future of the novel in the Times a couple weeks ago where he said, taken as a technological development, the book is still an incredibly user-friendly and sophisticated storage system, you know. And my wife, who's in IT, says, do you want to know the most reliable data storage system that's ever been developed? Paper, you know, because everything else has a technological half-life. You know, file protocols come in and out of fashion. They disappear. This pad that you've got the questions written on is still the most reliable system. If you want to be certain that your grandchildren can look at your papers and know what you thought and what you believed, that's the best place to put the stuff, you know.
It also feels so good in bed, too.
Well, indeed. And Glick talks about that in the essay, you know. They're still really comfortable. And I've seen these Kindles and everything, and I'm not a total skeptic. I'm not a Luddite about it. I think mass market fiction, for example, rack-size books are just as good on the Kindle, probably, because you're not keeping them. You're not going to reread that book, probably, and it's meant to be a sort of a temporary experience. But I don't find reading on the screen nearly as pleasurable, and I find I have a sort of an ADD relationship to screen reading.
But where the publishers go, not only editors, but publicists and networks and all sorts of promotion, centers of discussion. How in the world are we going to replace that?
I don't think that. I think trade publishing along the lines that it was construed is sort of in deep shit. I do. But I think that there are opportunities. In the same way the record business in the late 70s spawned all these indie labels and all these little boutique operations that are not, you know, money-making giants the way a Bertelsmann is a money-making giant or something. I think that boutique model may have real life in it, and it's being already sketched out by the university presses. You know, they're taking up some of the slack. They're publishing fiction, they're publishing poetry, in addition to scholarly books. And so there's room here for people who want to say culture is important to us and we don't necessarily need the same price point, the same profit opportunities mm-hmm. that these huge publishers needed. I mean, some of that was overpublishing, publishing too many books and so on. And there are publishers, I'm happy to say mine, for example, Little Brown, that have managed to do well in this particular moment and aren't reorganizing and so forth.
But so. You're also part of that wonderful McSweeney's, Dave Eggers generation that's been very creative about making new networks and finding new talent, new voices. Where's that going?
Well, he's a really good example because they have been publishing books primarily through using the web as a promotional tool and so forth. And I'm sure there will be a lot more of that in the same way that a lot of bands right now are self-releasing and promoting for themselves and so on. Maybe that's the model. Hmm. And what mass media does for us is sift through the great numbers of things that are happening out there and help point us to work that we're going to be interested in. So I have faith that literature still will happen, that books will still be published and so on, maybe just not in the way that we understand it now.
I wonder a couple things. What do you learn from students who want to be Rick Moody or Robert Coover? And then I have another question about the web. But what are you learning about the generation 20 years behind you at Brown University, for example, about the possibilities, the models, the heroes, the ambitions?
Well, it is really different for one. The kids seem far more technologically savvy than we were, and they seem to have all of popular culture at their fingertips all the time. They really do.
Scary.
But I do think a little bit, and you and I were talking about this before, that high culture has sort of taken a vacation for the moment, and that in our zeal in the 70s to collapse the high-low distinction, we've perhaps sacrificed the high a little bit, you know. And it's possible that that could make a bit of a comeback. I hope so.
I was referring to Philip Roth's remark. He was recalling a moment in the 50s at a conference in Chicago, I think, and the general assumption was the score in this contest was University of Chicago 9, popular culture 6, or something like that. It's now 10 trillion on the pop noise and high culture sort of gasping there. You think high culture let its claim go for a while? I mean, is this something that can be taken back by sheer energy? And who's going to do it?
No, I think probably it's a sort of corporatization of culture that's responsible for it. You know, I mean, as long as you're pursuing the big profit margin, your symphony is going to take a back seat because it's too expensive and so forth. You know, I mean, Europe's a better example of preserving its culture because the states in Europe put so much money into opera and into symphonies and into, you know, performance art and alternative kinds of events and forms and so forth. So it's been much more vigorous over there and in my mind, in a much more interesting, fascinating way. It would be great if the state would do that, if Obama would be like Kennedy and funnel a lot of money into the NEA, but that's obviously not going to happen with the country and the economic situation it's in. But I do think, you know, as Roland Barthes said, a negation is always the site of an affirmation, you know. And so as soon as you say, classical music is dead or jazz is dead, that's when a bunch of people start playing on the corner, you know, and it's where it becomes interesting again.
I look for new life on the web, and I'm always a little puzzled, still uncertain, but it's low overhead, it's easy access. What are you seeing among the new writing sprouts out there?
You know, I have deep suspicion about the web as a receptacle for writing because I think the language of blogging is subliterary. I don't think it qualifies, you know. And when these bloggers, some of whom I read and love, you know, but when they try to just slap that stuff between covers, you do not have a book. Mm-hmm. It's meant to be read in that forum, and it's best understood in that forum. But that doesn't mean that their responses and ideas about culture are not great, because there's real life in, you know, how voracious they are about whatever record is hot or whatever book is hot. But that doesn't mean that what they're producing is the same. It's still, bloggers still have to sit down and write a book just like every other writer if they want to make a book. They have to go through that turmoil and that commitment and that heartache, you know. Culture doesn't happen instantaneously in some cases. It requires real commitment. And that, in fact, is what I do notice about younger writers right now, is that they come from this kind of a nexus, this instantaneous web-oriented spot. And so they have a little collective ADD. They don't settle down as quickly as my generation did. And they don't come from that spot of, you know, I read for 20 solid years before I ever started a novel, and every book was still in here somewhere. It seems to me sometimes the younger generation would prefer to do the writing and not have to read all those books.
Really interesting point. I observe, as one who learned what little I know about anything, starting with newspapers and Red Smith and Jimmy Breslin, big deal in my college time, but all kinds of writers, and writers like Hemingway, Ring Lardner, who came out of a newspaper tradition. As the newspapers die, you sort of wonder who will be the sort of toilet training stylists for people who are interested in words, even writing just a plain good sentence.
Really good question. I mean, there are blogs that you probably read, Daily Cause and Talking Points Memo and those guys. I mean, that in some way is the influential political writing of the moment.
But the literary style, I would have to say, with great respect and affection for all those guys, it's dismal.
I agree.
The sentences are really piss poor.
I agree. So, you know, I'm not certain where, you know, high literary standards come from right now. The New Yorker, maybe, if the New Yorker can persist. But I think we have yet to find out what the effect of all this stuff is going to be. We're sort of hurtling along with the web as a tool, because it spawns its own progeny every day. You know, there's more stuff. But we haven't really thought about what's the effect if we're really interested in preserving this delicate, elegant line that we recollect from a Plimpton or a Mailer or something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. Mailer maybe supremely.
Yeah.
This is fascinating, Rick Moody. You're in a good mood, better mood than I've seen you before. You're about to be a father. There's a Moody moment underway, as well as an Obama moment. Where will we meet you again? What will you have written?
Well, I'm trying to finish this big, long book before the little urchin appears. And then I'm going to actually write on music. I'm going to write essays on music for a while.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so that's the next idea.
What kind of music and what kind of writing?
All kinds of music. I'm very Catholic in my tastes, so some jazz, some experimental, some rock and roll, some classical. And just to try to find broader cultural lessons in music that interests me.
Criticism,
yeah.
Analysis, performance?
A little of both. I mean, I can play. You know, I play a tiny bit, so I know my
And your axe is?
I play guitar and piano and sing some.
Good for you. Yeah. And where do you begin?
Well, I'm in a band, actually.
Ah, yeah. That's right, of course.
Sort of a folk music band. And that's my beat, really. Like, what moves my heart in music right now is very, very old folk music, like Appalachian folk music.
You've written about writing modernist music on very old foundations. Give us an example. You can hum a few bars if you like.
You know, for example, one thing we did is my band... We found that Woody Guthrie had stolen the melody for This Land Is Your Land from the Carter family, who in turn stole it from a blues singer, who in turn borrowed it from an Anglican hymnodist from 200 years ago. So we stole the melody back and we put new lyrics to it, which is what you can do. That's sort of the Pete Seeger idea that you should just steal the melody and make the words contemporary.
This is what we call open source music.
Exactly right.
Bach did it too.
Yeah, right. And all those guys, Dvorak stealing from Polish folk songs. And
Mahler stole from Brahms.
Yeah.
Or borrowed, respectfully.
Yeah. So that's the modernist approach to the folk music of the moment, I think.
And the new Rick Moody lyrics to This Land Is Your Land are what?
They stole it out from under our feet.
You stole it back. Rick Moody, this is fun. Good luck in everything, especially with the arrival of young Moody.
Thanks, Chris.
Really a pleasure. Sarah Archambault produced and Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Rick Moody. Feedback your own angles on what we're going through in Obama time, on what you're reading or writing, on what's missing in blogs, or the future of white guys from Connecticut at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thanks for joining the conversation.